This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins.
Our nation cannot afford another stimulus package, particularly one that is basically funding a social wish list and is not investing in our future.
Charlotte Mayor Pat McCrory, his comments on the federal stimulus package appeared this month in the pages of the Wall Street Journal, and we'll hear more from the mayor on the package and how the money is being used in Charlotte later in the program. First, a man who spent his professional life as an accountant and who, after retirement, found a new calling, that of art collector. Some of what he has collected is now on display at the Mint Museum. Obviously, Nelson Grice has an eye for art, and we're about to find out how he amassed such an impressive collection. He joins us in our Spirit Square studio all the way from Santa Fe, New Mexico. Welcome.
Thank you.
Good to see you.
Glad to be here.
And since some of the Native American works that he has collected are on display for you to see at the Mint Museum of Art in an exhibit called Passionate Journey, the Grice Collection of Native American Art, now through October 17th, we've also invited Dr. Dori Budet. Is that how you say your name? I just already forgotten.
Budet.
To be with us. She is curator for ancient American art at the Mint and several other museums around the country. Thank you for being here as well.
My pleasure.
Professionally, you were an accountant. You lived in Winston-Salem, born in Raleigh. Mm-hmm. You live now in Santa Fe. You became an art collector, and you've given this collection to the Mint. Why the Mint?
Well, North Carolina has such a wonderful history of pottery production, and the tradition of the Puebloans in New Mexico is so different than the wheel tradition that we have here. And so we just thought it would be wonderful to have the collection of pottery, particularly here in North Carolina, as sort of a comparison with what goes on at Penland and Seagrove.
Mm-hmm. How many pieces, and it's not just pottery, it's textiles, it's masks,
right,
it's baskets, it's other forms of art. But how many pieces are in this collection that's on display at the Mint Museum? Do you know? Does anybody know?
I don't know how many there are.
Because they're uncountable?
I don't know. No, there are several hundred, but I honestly do not have an account for you.
Is this all of your collection or just part of your collection?
I still have some masks out at my home, which I told the men until I leave mm-hmm. this earth, I'm not going to give them to them, but they're promised.
So you and your wife, your late wife Gretchen, are responsible for this collection, for amassing this collection. When did you begin?
My wife made a trip when they moved us to Houston. My wife made a trip to the Southwest and immediately fell in love with the whole area. Mm-hmm. And we started taking all of our vacations in the Southwest area, mainly Santa Fe. And we became so intrigued with the philosophy and worldview of the Pueblo and Native Americans and started collecting their artifacts.
What is that philosophy? What is that worldview?
Well, basically that the world is imbued with a single life force, and that Mother Earth is a living organism, and that rocks, clouds, everything on Earth is alive.
We have put some, six or seven photographs of some of the collection up on our website. You can go to wfae.org/Charlotte Talks to see these on our front page here. And I don't want to be specific about these six photographs or seven photographs, but I do want you to explain how that philosophy comes out of these works of art. How do you see that philosophy in these works?
Well, creating this pottery is for a Puebloan potter one long ceremony from the time that they thank the clay mother to allow them to gather the clay. They always pray in mm-hmm. advance for mm-hmm. that, to cleaning the clay, preparing it, and so forth. No commercial products are used in the production of this pottery. And so it's a long ceremony. You might call it a long spiritual ceremony to create one of these vessels. And they will tell you they believe that that vessel is alive. Has its own spirit.
Doctor, put this collection into some sort of perspective, because you're an expert on Mayan culture and Native American culture, etc. This collection of art that he has amassed, what is its significance?
The significance, first of all, for the Mint Museum is exactly what Nelson just said. It is an incredibly fine complement to the outstanding collections for which the Mint Museum is world-renowned. That is in the areas especially of textiles, of costumes, of European costumes. Now, Nelson and Gretchen's collection complements that with looking at clothing styles here in the New World among the Maya peoples of Guatemala and Mexico. The mask area also reflects what's in the textile collection, as well as the general concept of as art as performance. In the ceramics, again, showing this a complementary tradition in fine ceramics, but here from the New World, that is a reflection of similar ideas, but very different techniques as for the both the contemporary ceramics of North Carolina, as well as the decorative arts collections of the porcelains and the Delhomme collection at the Mint. With the baskets, we're looking at an element that's very, very much like the Craft and Design Museum, the other section of the Mint Museums. Yeah. I think in particular, what's very important about the collections, not only the fact that every single piece is of exquisite quality, but that what we're seeing here with the native arts from the New World is this nexus of fine art in the European concept and the concept of craft. As Nelson was saying, the entire process of making these artworks, it's a prayer. Mm. It is a reflection of the concept of the universe that these peoples have, so that craft and art actually come together, craft being the fine expression of technique, of making something beautiful, and art being the internal expression and creativity of universal spirituality.
This is an incredibly generous gift, it seems to me, a remarkably generous gift. How difficult, because you obviously enjoy the process of collecting, how difficult is it to part with all of this? I'm sure they'll give you a free pass to the museum to see it whenever you like, but how difficult?
I certainly hope so. It is difficult. To tell you the truth, Mike, what happened is that my middle son one night said to us, Mom, Dad, if you don't find a home for all of this before you depart, we're going to have a garage sale.
So they're not into this at all.
They're not collectors.
Wow.
So that gave us an epiphany.
Mm-hmm.
And so
where did you put all this in the house? I guess that's a good question to ask, isn't it? Because you have an enormous collection here.
My middle son is an architect, and he tore out the whole bottom of the house and put in a gallery. Now, we could not display the textiles, mm-hmm. and we gave those to the museum 10 years ago.
Okay.
The other collections we gave much later.
What's the secret to collecting? Dr. Bidet just said that these are wonderfully high-quality pieces. You obviously have a great eye for this. What's the secret of collecting? Did you always have a great eye? Did it develop over time?
We made a lot of mistakes.
Did you really?
It's a learning process. One of the joys of collecting is acquiring the knowledge of the culture and the art that you're collecting. And you do make mistakes at the beginning. There's no, every collector will tell you mm-hmm. that.
I mean, I think, are there things that you look at that are early in your collection that you dispose of or sell or hide away because you're embarrassed by the naivete of the fact that you collected it in the first place?
I don't know that I was ever embarrassed. Okay. I have given pieces, for instance, to the Wheelwright Museum for their annual auction of pieces that I thought I had better examples of later.
Mm-hmm. The textiles in here, and there's one up on our website right now, which is, I think, quite lovely. It's a blouse. It's red on the top, white on the bottom. I'm really abbreviating this. You'll have to go to our website to really see it. But why are these textiles art and not simply clothing?
Because if you keep in mind what clothing does, it keeps us warm. It keeps us socially acceptable. But really what it does is it transforms the biological body into a social being. And for the Maya peoples, the clothing is an expression of the foundation of life. It's expression of their place in the universe. It's an expression of their religious beliefs. And so woven into the designs of this clothing and into the clothing types themselves are the essence of being Maya. Once you start imbuing an object with spiritual aspects, with communal aspects, with intellectual history, mm-hmm. you transform the simple object, the simple blouse, into a work of art.
When you're confronted with things that you might want to look at to buy, how do you know? How do you know, I think I'll take that piece, but not that piece? How do you know?
Well, you learn, I think, what is a good design. Mm-hmm. And obviously you can recognize when the painting is very fine, beautifully done in perspective. This is, for the pottery, this is painting on a three-dimensional surface. And it's not an easy art form. But you gradually learn how to spot the really talented artists. And we always tried to spot artists early in their career, not only because the piece didn't cost as much, but to support those artists as opposed to buying a piece from an established artist.
Mm-hmm. And you have bought many pieces from the same artist over time?
There are a few artists that mm-hmm. we collected more than one piece. Lonnie Vigil, we have four or five pieces in the exhibit from him. He's one of the leading potters in the Southwest.
Lonnie Vigil, there are a number of vessels that he's created mm-hmm. in various shapes and uses and styles. We have one of them on our website right now at wfae.org/charlottetalks. It's an asymmetrical piece of pottery, and it was done in the 90s. At one time, Lonnie was a financial analyst in Washington, D.C., who felt drawn, as you have felt, to northern New Mexico to become a potter. Did you think, did you have something in common with him? Is there some simpatico relationship going on? Because you were an accountant, he was a financial analyst, he's an artist, you're an art collector?
No, quite honestly, Gretchen saw a beautiful pot in a museum store of Lonnie's early in his career, and we bought it, took it home, and she said, we need to collect this artist, and I agreed with her that it was fine, and we got in the car the next day and drove to Nombe Pueblo and simply hunted him down, and it has become one of the finest friendships I've mm-hmm. ever had. He's a marvelous person, very spiritual person.
We're talking to Nelson Grice, who's an art collector who originally from Winston-Salem, but he's donated his collection of American art to the Mint Museum. And along with us is Dr. Dory Boudet, who is the curator of this exhibit. There's a companion book to this exhibit, a beautiful book that the Mint has made available. And in that book, you write that the works in this collection are not simplistic curiosities of anthropological interest. Rather, they are embodiments of fundamentals of human experience and expression. I have about a minute left in this segment. Talk about that for a second.
What the purpose for art is to give us a way, as human beings, to explore our deepest feelings, to explore everything about the world that we find good, that we find bad. Art is an outlet for human spirituality. Every one of these works, to me, expresses that. And this is what you're asking about before. How do you know that a work of art is mm-hmm. a good work of art? It's because you feel it inside. Yes, you do study to learn what the universe of this artist's work looks like, but when you see good art, you know, because it's hitting that nexus of spirituality. That is the function of art.
I want to come back to that, because there are people out there who are afraid, I would think, in many cases, to buy art because they don't think they know what they're doing. I want to come back to that in a second. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Our program is made possible in part today by Carolina's Medical Center, recognized for service excellence under the J.D. Power and Associates Distinguished Hospital Program for inpatient experience. Details at carolinasmedicalcenter.org. You may have noticed the traffic, which got heavier this morning, is heavy normally, but now that school's back in, it's heavier still, and that's not your imagination. We live in one of the most congested metro areas in the country. We're third in the nation for highway congestion. And it's getting worse. And so there's a group of urban mayors throughout North Carolina who are holding a conference up at Lowe's Motor Speedway, I believe, this week to talk about how highway funds are allocated in the state. You may have noticed that most of the money goes to less populated areas. The cities get shortchanged here. They're going to see what they can do to stop that. And we'll talk to Mayor Scott Padgett from Concord about that tomorrow, and also the White House Deputy Director of Intergovernmental Affairs tomorrow at 9.
The Obama administration changes U.S. detention and interrogation policies. A new team of elite interrogators will report directly to the White House, and the Justice Department considers reopening past prisoner abuse cases. The Diane Rehm Show, Tuesday.
And you're invited to join the Diane Rehm Show this morning from 10 to noon, right after Charlotte Talks, on Listener Funded, 90.7 FM, WFAE.
We're back at Charlotte Talks on Listener Funded, 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Nelson Grice is with us. He's an art collector who has donated his collection of American art, Native American art, to the Mint Museum. It's on display through October 17th in an exhibit called Passionate Journey, the Grice Collection of Native American Art. Also with us is the curator of ancient American art for the Mint Museum, Dr. Dori Boudet. Talk to me about collecting, because she just said, Dr. Boudet just said, that you know it. You know a good work of art when you see it. Is that really true? Is it good because it speaks to you? If something speaks to you, then it's worth having?
Well, art is a way to enter another culture, or that's the way we looked at it. It's very difficult to enter another culture because core beliefs of a culture are so deeply embedded that you can't just walk into it. And art is one way that if you're alien to another culture, that you can enter that culture. And so we looked at collecting that way. So we were trying to collect pieces that from talking with artists, getting to know artists, they will automatically tell you, so-and-so is working at this other Pueblo, you really need to look at that artist, and so forth.
And your collection spans geographically from Alaska, as I understand this, Alaska to Guatemala. It's not just the Pueblo of the U.S. West.
The entire four collections do that.
Okay.
The basketry goes up into Canada and so forth, but we don't have pottery from Canada.
Now, the performance masks in this exhibit, the ones that I've seen so far, are stunning. I mean, they're exquisitely beautiful, and they are stunning works of art. And how, but they weren't designed to be art; they were designed to be performance oriented. Correct?
Well, that's true of so much of what's in the collections. In the languages of the Pueblo, and this is true of much of Mesoamerica, there is no word for art. There is no word for art in any of the Puebloan languages. It's simply a part of their traditions. They look at it as part of their everyday life. And so they don't separate art the way we do out. I remember one night at Adana, Christine McHorse, who is one of the great potters of the Southwest, said to us, you consider our beautiful vessels art. We simply consider it part of our life because we don't have a word for art. So it's a totally different tradition and a way of looking at things.
Seems to be a better way of looking at things.
Well, it's certainly a more holistic way.
Yeah.
And in this way, these people surround themselves with art. But it's simply part of who they are and what they do every day. And so they have an enriched experience as simply everyday life.
You can go into the average American home today, I would wager, the average American home, and not see a single piece of art that was collected as a piece of art. But are there examples of art in those homes that perhaps people don't think of as being art? They just like them. They're pretty. They're nice. They fulfill something inside of them, and they have it in their house, a little knickknack or something.
That is the definition of art.
So maybe we put this thing on a plateau that has scared people away.
And creates, I think, an artificial barrier.
Mm-hmm.
Because that does not exist. I think really the Native American concepts, which we also find in Asia, wherein that something that is beautiful and has a spiritual feeling to it is art, and it's simply how you create a good environment to make you spiritually whole.
And humans have always created art
Always.
Always. Why? And why don't we? Because these people don't think of themselves as artists that created these incredibly beautiful pieces that you've collected. Many of them don't. They just create them because that's what they do. Why don't we have more people just making things that they think are nice? Or do we?
I think what has happened is in our Western tradition, as we have ramped up everything, our lives are so fast, they're so filled, that we have pulled away from some of the fundamental aspects of being human. And I think it's a real tragedy, because what this is doing is impoverishing us as people.
Hmm. I have a good friend who would love this rabbit piece that you have, because she loves rabbits. But talk to me about this rabbit figure. We have it on the web right now. It's from the 90s by a self-taught artist named Nicolas Ortiz Estrada.
The rabbit is from Mata Ortiz, and a man named Juan Quesada regenerated the whole pottery tradition in northern Mexico by himself. And since then, the entire village depends on pottery for its entire existence. Everyone in the village pots. Every single family pots.
And where is this again?
This is just south of the border. It's near Casas Grandes in Mexico. It's not far below the border at all. And it's an amazing little village when you go there. I've been there only once, but it's an amazing village. But, you know, when you talk about these collections, when you think about it, these four different art forms are basic to the development of civilization, the development of mankind. Baskets coming first. If you don't have animal skins, you've got to have weaving. Mm-hmm. Pottery developed out of basketry. Masks were heavily involved in our spiritual development of primeval man and so forth. These are all very basic to the early development of human beings, these four art forms. Mm.
And basketry, which you have a considerable amount of in this exhibit, I understand that Anglo-tourism is to be thanked for saving basket artistry from extinction in the late 19th century, at least in parts of Mexico. Why? Because people came down there, saw it, wanted to collect it, and they saw there was industry in this?
She can comment better than I can, but when the train started west, it created a tourist looking for curios and so forth, souvenirs to take home. But why don't you comment on that?
What would have happened in the 19th century as Anglos moved into the American West, they were displacing native cultures, and native peoples were put onto reservations, and with the demise of their ways of life, so too went all of the accoutrements of daily life, and especially basketry. At the same time, Anglos were bringing containers made of tin and other materials that then supplanted basketry. So what happened, Nelson's correct, in the 1880s when the trains were first built through the Southwest especially, what happened was tourism developed in the United States. And the tourists were going through Indian territories looking for souvenirs to take home. And the native artists realized, there is an economic opportunity here. We are terribly impoverished. And so the women themselves revitalized basket making from making quotidian objects to making curios for the tourists.
You mentioned that the whole lower level of your home housed these objects until you donated them to the Mint Museum. What's there now?
Well, we've sold the home, and I guess what we did was tear out two bedrooms and a den to make the gallery. So I guess they've replaced those because they're living there now.
Do you continue to collect?
Mexican pottery. I do collect. In fact, I was in Mexico recently and bought five beautiful pieces of pottery from artists I was not familiar
with. Can ordinary people do this on a budget?
Yes, particularly in certain parts of Mexico, Tonalá, Tlaquepaque. The Mata Ortiz pottery is as expensive as southwestern pottery.
Nelson Grice is a collector of art. He's donated his collection of Native American art to the Mint Museum. It's on display now through October the 17th. Passionate Journey is the name of it, and it's curated by Dr. Dori Boudet, the curator of ancient American art at the Mint. Thank you both for being here. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
Pleasure.
Thank you.
South Carolina Governor Mark Sanford got a lot of press when he tried to reject the money coming to his state as part of the federal stimulus package. The Palmetto State's legislature ultimately overruled him. Charlotte Mayor Pat McCrory is also opposed to the stimulus package, yet he had to make his own ink by writing an article which appeared earlier this month in the Wall Street Journal. We're going to spend the rest of the hour talking to the mayor about his objections to the package in general, the $6 billion that North Carolina is scheduled to receive, and about how the money is being used in Charlotte. Welcome to the program. Welcome back.
It's great to be back. Thanks for having me.
Given the current economic situation and the kind of budget cutting being experienced throughout this city and throughout the county government as well, why oppose federal government stimulus money that may help in some way?
Well, I understand the stimulus package on the way it was sold was investing in our infrastructure, but it's not being spent that way. So had the stimulus package been passed with a firm strategy in place in which we're investing in infrastructure in the future, I would be in favor of it. But the more I've learned about it is less than 15% of the stimulus package is being spent on infrastructure. And also, of that 15%, most of the infrastructure that we're investing in is very short-term, like repaving roads. Mm-hmm. I said in the editorial in the Wall Street Journal, Roosevelt built dams, Eisenhower built highways, and this stimulus package is filling potholes. And yet the next generation is going to be paying the debt of this almost $1 trillion, and they'll have nothing to see for it, very little to see for it. And yet most people don't know about that, and I think it's my job to tell people exactly how the stimulus package is being spent and what are the long-term ramifications. And I'm critical in a bipartisan way because I saw a very similar trend occur after 9/11. After 9/11, everyone said to the president, we have to do something. Mm-hmm. So President Bush went into two wars, and we also spent several billion dollars on money going out to cities and towns to buy gas masks, to buy contamination suits, to buy SUVs, many of which are now in closets across the nation. I was very critical of that at that point in time because we just passed another appropriations bill after 9/11, and now we've passed just another appropriations bill after this economic crisis.
It could just be my faulty memory, and gosh knows I have one. But I recall that period after 9/11 when President Bush was and the Congress passed this stimulus package, and cities and towns like the size of Charlotte suddenly got these homeland security offices, and suddenly were stockpiling supplies like gas masks.
Every county sheriff got gas masks.
I recall that as being touted as something necessary and important and life-saving. I don't remember anything being said negatively about that in that time frame.
Well, I actually said something very negative about it in a press conference in Washington, D.C. with my fellow mayors next to me, in which I said this has become a money grab in which we're buying a lot of equipment that's going to be useless in 3 or 4 years. And I saw it as a money grab, and I saw no long-term strategy on how the money was being built. In fact, I gave an example at that point in time where everyone was trying to justify getting Homeland Security money because they were going to be the next ones attacked. And in fact, at that point in time, I'll never forget, someone in North Carolina, the governor at that time, actually justified giving money to pig farmers. And the logic was, well, wonder if the terrorists could attack the pig farms and all that waste is, poured over the state.
So did
we? People kept a straight face while saying that.
Yeah.
And I don't think terrorists were looking at pig farms at the time, but it was a way to distribute the money.
We established the Department of Homeland Security here in Mecklenburg County at the time. Does that office still exist? Does that title still exist? Did we waste the money?
Yes.
We did.
I think we wasted a large portion of the money. I'll be frank with you. I think every city and town and state wasted a lot of money on that because it became just an appropriations bill. The money was there, and people made sure they got their fair share. And it was distributed like the stimulus package through the governors, and the governors, with pressure that they have in their state capitals, have to give a little bit to everyone so everyone's satisfied, and we accomplish nothing.
Well, you're a politician. You ran for governor. How does this happen? We're obviously in a very critical situation in this country economically at the moment, and this this incentive package, the stimulus package, was, as you say, supposed to accomplish certain things, long-term things, shovel-ready projects, get people back to work so that we can inject some capital into the economy, not just from Washington, but because we pay these people to work, it goes out and it fans out and the money grows and grows and grows. And the projects that they build are lasting. You're saying we're fixing potholes, which is not lasting, and we're going to leave the bill for a lasting amount of time. How does this kind of thing happen?
Well, it happened because we had to, Congress and the president had to show that they were going to do something quickly. And just because you do something quickly doesn't mean you shouldn't read the bill on how the money is being spent, and you shouldn't do something strategically. In fact, I think President Obama, had he written the bill, would have done it differently. But it became basically a Nancy Pelosi appropriations bill from things that were in previous appropriation bills during the last 2, 3, 4 years that they could never get through Congress. And the definition of, quote, shovel ready was, I think, the most harmful thing to the bill that could have happened, because that meant two things. One is shovel-ready projects tend to be those where we've already done the engineering and design, and they have to be done only by construction workers. Well, it's not only construction workers that are hurting in this economy. There are architectural firms right here in Charlotte that are laying off hundreds upon hundreds of people because they have no work to do. There are engineering firms that are hurting terribly in this city because they have no work to do. But the shovel-ready projects didn't help them a bit. And I think we should have done more of a Roosevelt or Eisenhower-type program where we compiled this money together and did some big-bang projects. Instead, we did a Mint Hill repaving project and widened the road a little bit, which will not have long-lasting value. And that's very expensive money that we're using because we're borrowing debt from debt. And most experts say that's about $1.40 for every dollar you spend.
Well, these Roosevelt projects, most of them were federally run, were they not? I mean, they weren't local projects.
No, they were big, like power generation
TVA,
yeah. The dams, major roads, major parks. We're not doing that.
On the one hand, you sound very political when you criticize the Obama administration and the Democrats for doing it this way. On the other hand.
Yeah.
For years, Republicans have been railing against Roosevelt for all the terrible things he did during the Great Depression to bring us out of it, like these public works projects. They didn't like those.
I think some of the
can
public,
you have it both ways?
No, I don't think you can have it both ways. If you just waste the money. One compliment I have is in Roosevelt, and I also have with Eisenhower, is they spent this federal money with long-term results in which we're seeing the impact today. And the concern I have is we're about to spend $1 trillion, only which, by the way, about 10 to 15% has been spent up to this point in time. Very little of the stimulus package has been spent. Mm-hmm. In fact, in the city of Charlotte, we've only spent about $250,000. And that was for some summer job programs that ended this week. And this concept that we're creating new jobs is also a little misleading, because the new measurement is we've either saved or created new jobs. There is no measurement available to measure what jobs have been saved. So it's being made up by politicians right now, including mayors and governors and people in the federal government.
We're talking to Charlotte Mayor Pat McCrory, who has some problems with the federal stimulus package. We'll find out more about how he thinks this ought to be used, how the city of Charlotte is using it, and what the outcome of that will be as we continue our conversation in just a moment. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Our program is made possible in part today by Tyndall Subaru in Gastonia. There's a lot to love at Tyndall Subaru in August, with a full line of all-wheel drive Subaru vehicles, including the new 2010 or 2010 Subaru Outback and Legacy. Details available at TyndallSubaru.com. Coming up at 10 o'clock on the Diane Rehm Show, Catty Kay is in for Diane, who had an accident on a sidewalk in Washington this week and will be out of commission for a little while, actually. And they'll be talking about CIA interrogations of detainees. Attorney General Eric Holder has appointed a prosecutor to investigate whether CIA interrogators or contractors may have violated anti-torture laws. An update on the Obama administration counterterrorism policies coming up at 10 o'clock today on the Diane Rehm Show. We're back with Mayor Pat McCrory talking about the federal stimulus package and his objections to it in 30 seconds.
The Carolina Panthers preseason wraps up with a game against the defending Super Bowl champion Pittsburgh Steelers Thursday, September 3rd, and WFAE is giving away a pair of great seats. The contest winner will be notified by email. Entries must be received by midnight on Friday, August 28th. Register to win at WFAE.org/football and use the code word TICKET.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Pat McCrory is our guest, the mayor of Charlotte, obviously, and we're talking about the federal stimulus package, which he has been critical of. And once again, you were critical of the stimulus package that followed 9/11. You were telling me in the break that when you criticized President Bush's 9/11 stimulus, which was actually the Congress's stimulus, you were referred to as being unpatriotic?
Well, I was concerned because anyone who criticized anything that the government was doing after 9/11 was called unpatriotic. That was the kind of the McCarthyism litmus test at the time, which was uncalled for, including those who objected to the war. And I criticized my fellow Republicans for saying, no, this should have been good debate. And now I think there's, during this first year of the President Obama's administration, there's been a little hesitance to criticize anything he's done for fear of being against hope and change. Listen, I'm for change, but it's got to be the right kind of change. And I think there's some similar types of pressure. And I even see it now with the healthcare debate, that if you're against the specifics of exactly what was being proposed, you're against healthcare reform. And I think it's kind of a message to our leaders. Just because you're dealing with a crisis and you've got to move fast doesn't mean what you're doing shouldn't be transparent, shouldn't be open to debate, and shouldn't be strategic for long-term results. And I think we made that mistake after 9/11. I think we made that mistake with the stimulus package, and we may be making that mistake again, even as part of the healthcare reform.
So in your article in the Wall Street Journal, you called the fact that the bill mandates the money go to shovel-ready projects. You called that a big mistake.
And most mayors, by the way, most mayors, Democratic and Republican, say this behind the scenes because most major cities don't have shovel-ready projects.
Let's define that. How many shovel-ready projects in Charlotte are there, and what are they?
We had no road shovel-ready projects. The only money that the city of Charlotte in 300 square miles is getting out of the whole stimulus package is $4 million. And we're using it to buy technical equipment to help with congestion mitigation.
And we're using it to
hire
police officers.
Which creates almost no jobs.
We're using it to hire.
Now, I was talking about the road transportation.
Okay.
And we're also going to get money. We've been promised up to this point in time $40 million. About 19 of that is going to be spent for a maintenance facility for our buses. We could not spend it. I would have rather spend it on engineering studies for the North or Northeast rail line to continue the light rail.
And we couldn't do that because it's not shovel-ready.
Because it's not shovel-ready. But we're not thinking long-term. And that would have created a lot of jobs, too. But this definition of shovel-ready. And I told Vice President Biden, I was invited to the White House, and there's some energy grants. We're hiring a consultant this week for about $250,000 to tell us how to spend $6.5 million of energy grants, that we have to hire someone $300,000 to do that. I told Vice President Biden on the phone in a conference phone call, which I really appreciated him taking, along with three other mayors, and he said, how are the energy grants going? And I was very direct with the Vice President. I said, well, Mr. Vice President, we've been given 3 weeks to submit ideas, and with all due respect, you're going to get some crap. I couldn't believe I said that. And you know what? To Vice President Biden's credit, I really want to give him credit. He said, I understand, Mr. Mayor.
Charlotte's getting, what, 50 new police officers as a result of this stimulus?
That's correct. Now, that's short-term. That pays for 2 to 3 years of police.
So is that one of your criticisms, or is that not one of your criticisms?
Well, I think, frankly, the hiring of police should be local. And the minute
because
you start depending...
that's not infrastructure, and it's not shovel-ready. So how's that money getting to the hiring of police
because
officers?
Because that had to do with a rollover from extending the Clinton COPS program from over 10 years ago, which was supposed to be... I was one of the mayors who helped negotiate that during my first or second term as mayor, and that was supposed to be one-time grants to help cities hire new police officers. And this is the danger of getting one-time grants for operating from the federal government is 100,000 new police officers were supposed to be hired. Believe me, not close to 100,000 new police officers were hired.
It also puts a burden on the future, doesn't it? Because
Either
that or you fire these guys in 3 years when the money stops. I mean, how do you fund it going forward?
We are holding money in our budget in the city of Charlotte. In our long-term five-year budget, we are holding money on the side. But I'm telling you, a lot of cities are not going to do that.
But according to many economists and people who talk about how money flows through the economy, that when you create jobs, 50 police officers, 50 jobs, when you create jobs, there's a long-term benefit because they spend money, they rent houses, they buy houses, they buy cars, they have phone bills, and the money that they're making on their salary trickles out and multiplies within the economy. Isn't that stimulus?
The best stimulus is getting private sector jobs, not public sector jobs. Any economist will tell you hiring more government employees is short-term stimulus because of the recurring cost. If we could get money, for example, if we had built long-term infrastructure like dams or power plants or environmental studies and transit, that would have hired private sector engineering and architectural firms throughout the city of Charlotte, which would have had more of a long-term impact.
There's a Republican running for mayor who thinks the whole transit thing is foolish, and I'm modifying his words. I'm paraphrasing and modifying them. He's much stronger about
you're talking
that.
About Mr. Davis,
that's
not
right.
Mr. Laster.
Well, yes, I am. Yeah. He just doesn't believe in it, and you would like to see that money being used to study, not build yet, because we can't build it yet, but to study.
Well, not to study.
To do the engineering
stuff.
We
have to do engineering.
Right.
You have to do the design and implementation. That's how I think the money
Why is it important? Why is that long last? Tell me, why is he wrong and you're right?
Because the next generation will see the benefits of transit as we're seeing it much quicker than I ever anticipated today. The generation, two or three generations from now, will be riding those transit lines to UNC Charlotte and to Huntersville, and they'll be paying the debt for that transit also. Mr. Davis is, by the way, the same guy who every Monday night comes to council meetings and calls me an extreme liberal. A radical.
We're still in the beginnings of this stimulus package, and if you had a conversation with the vice president earlier this year about this, why can't ongoing conversations from mayors, other people around the country at your level and above, why aren't they having these conversations with the president's administration and the Congress saying this is a waste of money, here's what we ought to be doing with this money, let us plan our light rail expansion, let us plan highways, let us do this, let us do that. Why aren't those conversations being had?
Some of those conversations are being had, but the bill's already been written, the bill's already been passed, and frankly, there's a little fear of retaliation that if you fight it and you say you're against part of it, then you won't get any money, and the money will be redistributed. In fact, I've gotten some criticism by even criticizing some of the way the stimulus package is being spent. There is some fear that we could be punished as a result of
saying it. Well, knowing that, why did you do it?
Because I think it needs to be said. This is adult money that the next generation is
going
to
have to pay for. Would you have said it if you were running for mayor again?
Absolutely. I was saying it the minute the bill was passed because I actually read the major portions of the bill and went, this isn't the way they're selling it. I said it when I was mayor when the Homeland Security money was being spent. And I was on the President Bush's Homeland Security team. And
because if you don't agree with the way the money's being spent locally, there's nothing to lose by getting out there and saying something negative that might cause the money to be cut. Because we did a program on this.
No, there is something to lose because this is the catch-22.
All right.
You mentioned Mark Sanford at the beginning. I know it's not a good name to bring up at this point in time. He got criticized for just rejecting it.
Right.
I'm getting criticized for accepting it while also criticizing it. I mean, they've put you in a no-win situation. And the reason I'm going to go ahead
and... You wanted to be a politician.
Yeah. The reason we need to go ahead and accept the money is because it's our money and we're going to pay the debt. And if we don't accept it, the money will be diverted to New York City or to L.A. or San Francisco, and we'll still have to pay that.
We did a program on this topic last week, and I was surprised to find, yet not really given the history of the state's treatment of Mecklenburg County, at least from Mecklenburg's point of view, that we did not have a lot of highway projects slated to receive stimulus funds. We're getting $8.3 million to widen Highway 51 from Downs Circle in Pineville to the South Carolina line, and $17 million to rebuild Highway 218 from 485 in Mecklenburg to U.S. Highway 74 in Anson County. And this troubles you, too, I understand. There's no money in this package for finishing 485.
There were only two cities or towns in North Carolina that miraculously got a large chunk of one-time stimulus money for new highways. One was New Bern, North Carolina, which just happens to be the hometown of our new governor. And the other one was Fayetteville, which also happens to be the hometown of one of the most powerful state legislators. They had their act together. They somehow knew the rules. And in the first round of stimulus money, they got $40 to $50 million directed toward an outer beltway being completed.
485. Mm-hmm. Is that not shovel ready? I was told last week that it's not, that we don't own the right of way for the missing piece of the beltway.
They haven't bought the right of way. That's when.
Why?
You'll have to ask the state this.
Almost done. It's like the buckle is missing.
When the governor, Purdue made the promise to finish I-85 early, those of us in the know knew it couldn't happen because we knew that the money wasn't there and it wasn't at the point to do it.
And no money for roads in this package in the city of Charlotte because there are no shovel-ready projects? Is that why?
State roads. Now, the state only allowed state roads to be considered in the distribution. And usually,
that was their decision, not the federal government's decision?
I don't know. It was the state's decision to limit it to only state roads. And in any major metropolitan area, if you're going to redo a state road, you've got to do many more environmental studies before those have to be complete.
Article correctly, you also believe that the state is using a narrower definition of what shovel-ready means as compared to the federal government.
I think they are. I think they've made a very narrow definition, primarily to help, for two reasons, help redistribute the money across other parts of the state. And second, the problem we have is we have got to open up another Pandora's box here is the equity formula, which means any federal money that we do get from the federal government, the state will take the equal amount away and redistribute it to the rest of the part of the state as the part of this so-called equity formula, which I've been trying to change. And I'm proud to say that the mayors of North Carolina are going to be meeting in Concord today. Mm-hmm. We're meeting at the Concord Motor Speedway, and our major topic is to change the equity formula so metropolitan areas can get a fair share of road money. And I'm very proud mayors of Durham, Winston-Salem, Gastonia, Concord, Wilmington, we're bipartisan, we're great friends, and we want reform of how highway money is being spent.
Do you think you'll be listened to, that you'll have any clout?
Well, the good news is we got no change this year in the legislature, but there apparently is going to be a study commission for the umpteenth time to look at it again, and we're going to try to put as much public
pressure. In the legislature?
Yes.
Well, don't you think that's a way just to postpone the inevitable, which is no change?
Right now, the way they're making up the legislative committee, I would say yes.
Why?
If it was set up, by the way.
Why is it done this way? You ran for governor. Why does the state do this to the big cities that need this money?
Because the political power is elsewhere.
How can that be? The voters are here.
The political power is elsewhere due to seniority, due to where the current powerful state politicians come from, and due to where their at least past power base was. And I saw things on the governor's trail that made me realize that we do have a culture of corruption in state government right now, and we need major reform.
What road projects or other projects would you, in the best of all possible worlds, would you like to have seen this money, this federal stimulus money? go toward within the city of Charlotte or Mecklenburg County?
Well, finish the Outer Beltway, put money toward the Northeast Rail Line and the North Rail Line would have been my top three. I do agree with the governor on one major project. I want to compliment her on this, and that is the Yadkin River Bridge. Does have the possibility to have a one-time grant, but there's a little danger that the Yadkin River Bridge might not be shovel-ready enough to qualify for the funds, which would be a travesty. And if that fails, by the way, we've put in a secondary grant to see if we can get some money for the North Rail Line going toward Huntersville. But frankly, there's some
time. You're talking about the Yadkin River Bridge on I-85.
Right.
The one that's really old.
The most dangerous bridge in North Carolina.
And it wouldn't be shovel-ready because no plans have been drawn up, no engineering studies have been done to replace it?
There's a concern. There's a separate pot of money for one-time grants across the nation, and one of them, the Yadkin River Bridge, may qualify. The danger of that qualification is it might not be completed. They might not be able to complete it within 4 years, which is ridiculous. Why not make it a 7-year project? We are still hiring people throughout that whole process. And these are some of the limitations that Congress put on the stimulus bill that doesn't make long-term sense, and people need to know it.
But you're not optimistic that any changes can be made, even your articles and other mayors who may agree with you or governors who may agree with you. You're not going to be able to change this.
I think the only thing I'm trying to say is as people are talking about a new stimulus package possibly being implemented, I'm saying let's first learn about the first stimulus package that most people did not read.
How often have you written articles like this in publications like the Wall Street Journal that reach a national audience?
This might have been my only first
or second
time.
Did they ask you to do this, or did you just
send
it in? You just sent it in.
I sent it in, and as a result, I've been on national broadcast on CNBC and Fox and several other business news reports.
That act, I only have a minute left here, but that act is the act of somebody who wants to continue to have an impact, who wants to continue his political career. You chose not to run for re-election as mayor. Why?
One reason is because I decided to run for governor, and I knew after the governor's race, if win or lose, I wouldn't have the energy to do it. And second is I think it's time after 14 years for me to seek another opportunity, whether it be in the public sector or private sector. I love being mayor. I could do it the rest of my life, but my soul tells me now's the time to allow someone else that great opportunity.
Mayor Pat McCrory, you can read his article in the Wall Street Journal on their website about the federal stimulus package. He's very much against the way it's being handled as this conversation has unfolded. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks a lot. Appreciate it, Mike.